Morning. I was going to start with kind of a dumb joke about holding your applause to the end, but Beth has so lowered the expectations that... that just went by the boards completely. So, thanks for having me. There's no particular reason you should be familiar with who I am unless you've been here before, but if you're new, you might be forgiven for reading the bulletin and asking yourself why in the world a professor of management is speaking on consciousness, moral or mortal. And that's a really great question. I must confess I started life as a philosopher, well, at least a philosophy professor anyway, and so it's not quite as large a mistake as it might seem to have me here. In my area of what they call in academic circles, what they call my area of competency was comparative religious ethics, especially Buddhism and Christianity. So that's part of where I'm coming from. Today, excuse me. All right. I'm using as my text Evan Thompson's book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, Self and Consciousness in Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy. An easy 400-page read if you have a chance in your spare time. I'll refer to it if I lose track of things, but mostly what I want to do is just talk about the way that classical Indian philosophy conceptualized the self. I know you've talked a lot about the self or absence of self in prior meetings, so hopefully this is not too redundant. But what I want to do, I think, more than anything else today is get to a point where we can take some of this stuff from Indian slash Eastern philosophy that seems so unapproachable and so difficult to get your head around, so abstract, non-duality, you know, the no self, a lot of these notions that you wonder, how could, you know, what is this grounded in, and do I have to be a sage and, you know, go off to a cave in India forever? The answer to that question, by the way, is yes. And by the way, just spoiler alert on this, is consciousness mortal? The answer is no. from these perspectives, you know, if the answer was yes, I could have saved us a lot of time and trouble. I could have just emailed you that and called it a day, right? We've been done. Is consciousness moral? Well, it depends. What I'm relatively certain of is that it's the prerequisite for morality. If you're not conscious in any way, it gets difficult to ascribe agency and then morality. So. Is that good? Is that two birds and one stone? Is that okay? Please hold your applause to the end. All right. So, between the Vedic and Upanishadic period in India, the Vedas a collection of hymns that were largely interested or concerned with identifying who the gods were and are. And then the ritual sacrifices and the ways you should approach them, the various hymns. And 1,000 years later, the Upanishad period, where you're talking about the philosophy, you're sort of drawing out, literally means to sit at the feet of some sage or teacher. And I think we better not go with sage. And listen to what they have to say about the various concerns, including the nature of the self, the nature of death, the relationship with God or gods, and all of that. And they broke the self up into four quadrants, okay? And as I'm talking about this, here's hopefully the takeaway value. Think about, listen to it critically, if you would. Think about if you think they're really onto something or not. So the first one, I hope, is relatively obvious that, you know, no one except the most persnickety, obnoxious philosopher would argue with, and that is we are conscious. There is something called waking consciousness. And it is the fundamental root of subject-object perception. And we're here, and lots of it has to do with outside phenomenon that we take in through senses, and there's this faculty of the mind or faculties of the mind that process this. And we've got some sense that, you know, at least it appears you certainly are other than me. You know, all this, and people get nervous about Indian philosophy, it's because we're all one. Well, no, we're not. Maybe at some level, but there's also clearly distinctions. And in Indian philosophy, they call this course, or One of the Sanskrit words actually often gets interpreted or translated as gross consciousness, waking consciousness. And there are levels to that, but generally speaking, we're awake. Most of you hopefully will stay that way for, it's only 20 minutes, you can do it. and you'll be fine. And there are lots of stuff we can apprehend and know by waking consciousness, but it is coarse and it exists in what the Buddhists came to call the desire realm. It tends to be a little hard to keep one's attention in the waking realm. It's, and these days, obviously, the attention spans are even shorter, but there's a lot of other stuff to pay attention to. There's a lot of stuff to be distracted by. There's a lot of outside phenomena coming in, a lot of stuff that to be perceived. And so whether you're, you know, Hindu or Buddhist, I'm going to use the word Hindu and Hinduism, though if you're ever there in India, try to go with this phrase, which is Sanatana Dharma, which is translates as something like perennial philosophy or universal teaching. The Indians don't mind that you use Hinduism, but it is a 19th century Western anthropological term. So, and also, Sanatana Dharma just sounds a lot cooler, right? I mean, it's like you could show off. It's cool. In both traditions, though, you get this notion of kind of this gross or unsubtle consciousness. And let me foreshadow where we're going here. There's a movement in Indian philosophy where there are a number of parallels in which, whether it's death or meditation or your family life, there's a movement from gross waking consciousness, inability to pay attention, desires buffeting you one way or the other, to what they refer to and what gets translated then as subtle consciousness. And one of the outstanding differences between the East and West in this regard, at least if you're going with consensus Western cognitive and neuroscience, is Western science tends to think of consciousness as either absent or present. And if you're waking and able to apprehend and name things, you're conscious. And if you're not, even in a state of dreamless sleep or under deep anesthesia, we can tell by the machines we have that you're still alive, and we can also tell you're still alive because you wake up. Those two things are bases for that. But there's no real, you know, sort of evidence with the equipment that we have that you're necessarily conscious in the way that we in the West generally or normally use that term. But as I move through these four quadrants, these four parts of the self, you'll see from waking consciousness to dream consciousness to dreamless sleep to what they call pure awareness in the fourth one, you don't lose anything that they refer to as consciousness. And it's really a very, very subtle but important difference between at least Western scientific understandings and Eastern subjective experiential meditative practices and what they've learned from that. So this, if the first one is waking consciousness, the second one is dream consciousness. And the thinking here is you go into to sleep and the mind projects you as the subject in your own dream. So there's a dream ego, essentially, and you're not actually in the world of, you know, real streets and buildings and people. It's all a projection of your mind's ability to remembering, taking material from the day or farther back in time or from perhaps other places, including past lives, and bring yourself to a point where you're creating whole worlds, and the dream world is seen as sort of a precursor or possible entryway into the entirely other world. So you've got waking consciousness, dream world, other world. And one of the ways to talk about it is like we're like fish, or our consciousness is kind of, we never really touch the banks of either. We're just in this stream. But there is a way to harness the energy in your mind to penetrate into and beyond the dream world. All right, here's where it gets a little more interesting for me. So now, the third quadrant, dreamless sleep. You come back, you say, I slept the sleep of the dead. I have no recollection. I was out like a light, you know, slept like a log, whatever it was. If the interpretation of that from a Western point of view is, okay, that's the absence of consciousness. The classical Indian position on that is, no, what's really happening there, and you've experienced it, all of you, if you've had a moment like that, is that's subtle consciousness. That's what they mean by that. Now, how would they know that? What's subtle? How do you explain if I have no recollection of it? And they turn that back around on you and say, well, you do have a recollection of it. What you're saying is, you know, I slept really, really well. I slept so well that I don't remember anything. I was completely out of it. And it was a game changer, I think, for me and a lot of people when we came across that notion. Because one, it suggests that all of us, if we've had that experience, we're 3/4 of the way basically to the soul's liberation, moksha, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it. And two, we've really badly or maybe ignorantly conceptualized what consciousness is and what it requires. And so rather than, you know, thinking of it in Eastern terms, well, I'll be just as alive and awake as I am now, just in a different body, rebirth or reincarnation. And that's good because, you know, I don't have to die, like endlessly die, never, you know, have any kind of, quote, consciousness again. Or the Western sense, whether it's heaven or hell or some other conception you have, where there is a kind of reformulation of what happens after death that's very anthropomorphic, very much along the lines of waking consciousness. And the Eastern insight is, let's just kind of rethink that a little bit. Said, this subtle consciousness is a kind of peaceful absolution of all dichotomies, of all differences, of all dualities. So when people say non-duality, what does that mean? What's that experience? If you've ever had that kind of dreamless sleep where you're absolutely out of it, the meditative practice that's promised by the various yogas in Hinduism and some of the practices in the Vajrayana and Madhyamaka practices in Buddhism say you can become lucid and aware of that experience. When they talk about, oh, the peace that comes from that, the bliss, etc., you've had it, and you can remember at least the fruits of it. I feel so rested. I feel so at ease. I feel so at peace. Said, that's subtle consciousness. How do you get there? Well, the grasping, I'm sure that Brad has talked about this, the kind of sense of self that doesn't allow us to move much beyond the desire realm. And by the way, dreaming sleep is, at least for the Buddhist, also considered a part of the desire field or the desire realm, in which even in dreams, whether it's wish fulfillment or vicarious acting out of something the ego, you know, the sort of classic notion of the self, is trying to expatiate or get to or release in some way. The cultivation of the subtle consciousness in dreamless sleep. And by the way, this coming to this realization, this is going to be a little indelicate, and I apologize, but it really, really helped me as I was struggling with notions of consciousness and sort of Western scientific ideas, which I'm very partial to, combined with the Eastern stuff that I find compelling experientially. It really helped me with what happened like during a colonoscopy. sorry about that, but the first time I had one, I said, well, I don't ever want to do that again, but at the same time, it's like, you know, my wife said, man, oh man, that if that's death, you know, that utter sort of blackness and other sort of complete, you know, wiping out of everything, it's just the long sleep, you know, it's just the death is an endless colonoscopy. you know, maybe it won't be as bad because you certainly don't want to wake up from one. But the Eastern, I went back to this notion, you know, of this very subtle consciousness. And Western psychology actually does have an inkling of this. They just, you know, it's not as popular as the neuroscience at the moment. But think of all this sort of phenomenal stuff that happens, not phenomenal and outstanding, but just phenomenon that enters our sphere that we're not necessarily conscious of that yet may affect our behavior. The Eastern classical tradition just has developed that, I think, to a greater extent than the Western, by saying, okay, lucid dreaming, deep meditative states, strong visualization practices in which you identify with certain psychic phenomenon or power, all of these get you to a point where you understand that this kind of gross consciousness is, that's what they mean by the illusion. Not that it's not there. It's that there is something in deeper than that and more subtle that actually leads us to a place where this kind of peace or equanimity or balance or the kinds of things that people are forever writing books about and talking about actually is possible after 4,000 years of meditation in a cave under really difficult conditions with a teacher who beats you and yells at you. And that all comes from experience. I don't know about the 4,000. All right. So if dreamless sleep is something that we really should be paying attention to, because the evidence that it is links to this third quadrant, this notion of subtle consciousness, is true, based on our ability to remember it, to feel the results of it, then it, in turn, at least in the Sanatana Dharma, in the Hindu side of things, takes us one step further, which is to this fourth, which they call pure awareness. And that's where you get into these notions of Atman is Brahman. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but basically, ultimately, the self, what the Hindus call Atman, is none other, not different from, identifies with and participates in what they refer to as Brahman, which is this underlying universal essence out of which all things, it's the silence from which all sounds emanate. It is the energy from which all other energies emanate. One of the analogies they use, or metaphors if you like, to help people get a sense of this, is think of waves on the ocean. And individually, right, we're like waves. But we are certainly not disconnected from the ocean. So that still infinite essence, unchanging, that is the ocean, right, emanates these individual particular beings, all of us, and they don't have an origin story. They don't have a, you know, like an original sin story. It's just the nature of things. But there is a path back to this kind of oceanic eternal bliss. And I got to admit, as I get older, that one's very attractive to me in lots of ways. Because if they're right, if this is that, this Atman, the soul of me is none other and not distinct from Brahman, the unchanging essence of the entire universe forever, then there is no death, right? So the first answer to that question from a Hindu perspective is consciousness mortal? No, it's not mortal. One, because it's incredibly subtle and can be experienced as such, not just in deep sleep, but in meditation, yogic practices. And two, ontologically, it's in the nature of being that it is part and parcel of the essence, the very essence of the universe, unchanging. It's not God. Gods emanate from it as well. It's not a personal relationship. It's just what is. It's the fundamental nature of being. Now, the real distinction between Hinduism and Buddhism on that score is the Buddhists are a little less clear that this pure, they're with you for the first three. So they're not so sure that the fourth one is actually there. There are minority schools in Buddhism that do talk about a kind of Buddha nature or consciousness that is unchanging. But I'm sure you'll know that, you know, if there's anything that's critically important to the Buddhists, it's that everything's impermanent and everything is changing. So their sense that everything is, including consciousness, is always subject to arising and falling of conditions and circumstances, and always impacting one in ways that are either to one's advantage or not. In both instances, though, it is true that karma is what dictates the nature and quality of the rebirth. So in Hinduism, what I described was the best case scenario. it's true that you can never die. That's the good news. The bad news is you can be reborn forever. And in Hinduism, the relevant distinction here between reincarnation and rebirth merits just a mention. Because the Hindus do have a notion of this unchanging essence, the Atman, that isn't different from Brahman, that takes different forms by being reincarnated, that essence, depending upon the karma, the karmic impetus. Everything I've ever said, done, thought, and the intent, the strength of the intent I have behind that. Okay, and so then that soul migrates from body to body, realm to realm, ultimately getting tired of that, hopefully at some point, and finding a karmic or yanatic or bhaktic path to liberation, to moksha, and realizing that I'm really not different than Brahman. The Buddha sat down under the tree, thought, well, that's interesting. Let me meditate on that for a minute. And looked and looked and looked and couldn't get there. He couldn't find the unchanging essence. Just, you know, I'm looking, trying, meditating deeply. It's good faith effort, you know, but I don't see it. All I see is impermanence all the way down. And so the moment of death, if the moment of death for Hindus is driven by karmic forces that lead the soul from reincarnation to reincarnation, for Buddhists, it's rebirth to rebirth. The subtle distinction there is no one unchanging essence to this, to me, to you. Everything is a process, everything is a stream, everything is always part of a number of causes and conditions that arise and fall. That it's not that there isn't an ego continuity, you know, Michael DeWild, for better or worse. It's that upon the moment of death, I've got a few choices depending upon how well I've prepared myself. Now, again, if the whole point of, or one of the points, let's say, of living from a Hindu or Buddhist point of view is to move from this more outward-facing, perception-based, attention-seeking, desire-fulfilling, you know, gross consciousness to this very subtle understanding and experience of consciousness that is actually in tune with or in line with what it means to be liberated, what it means to be at peace, what it means to overcome subject-object dualities, what it means not to be driven or riven by desires all the time. Right, then what I move into at the moment of death with Buddhism is actually something more like a choice. And I spent a lot of time on this, but I know I'm coming to the end of time, so I'll wrap it up with a little, nod to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bodor Tobel, in which, because people ask me this all the time, well, if there's nothing permanent in about the self, Professor DeWild, then what is it that takes rebirth, huh? It's like the Buddhas have never thought about this, right? It's like, oh, shit, you're right. I'm sorry. Never mind. Forget Buddhism. So there is a moment in both traditions where it's the clear drop of consciousness that goes by different names, the luminosity of pure awareness, etc., that if you've been preparing yourself for it, you will recognize you can use that moment to awaken, to realize what it is, the nature of grasping, that keeps you cycling from rebirth to rebirth in samsara, and you can halt that process. And by the way, like every other major wisdom tradition, both the Hindus and the Buddhists have an out, right? It's like, well, if I just confess all my sins at the last moment, even though I've been a terrible person, is that okay? Well, okay. And the Hindus have one, which is if you happen to be in Varanasi, the holiest city on the Ganges, when you die, and you've got Om on your lips, Om, the primordial sound of Brahman, and you happen to die there, the Brahmins, the priests will say, yeah, you know, your chances of going to moksha are pretty good. But nonsense. Right? It's a scam. Don't believe them. It's all karma all the way down. And by the way, and then the Buddhist tradition, especially in the Vajrayana or Tibetan tradition, at that moment of the clear light, if you see it, if you've been preparing yourself for it, if you've been lucid dreaming, if you've been meditating, doing what you're supposed to be doing, right? You recognize that as you're out. That's the moment where, I don't have to take rebirth. I don't have to be driven by my karma to this endless cycle of dying and living. So in both cases, the answer is no, consciousness itself is not mortal. But for most of us, it's going to take us more than one time around to figure that out. So have some grace. Be patient with yourself. You know, if you don't get it this time, no problem. It's coming back. Hopefully we wish you. There's a whole practice called the Amitabha Buddhism practice where we just like wish you a better rebirth. Oh, mama namaste. Better rebirth, good for you, you know, better conditions, better opportunities to practice these dharmas, get these insights. But the key takeaway is be careful of the Western notion that cuts off consciousness in ways that might not be true. There might be more to it, ultimately, than our normal waking experience allows. So thanks for listening. Appreciate it.